This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A remnant of the Cold War still lingers in Cincinnati, but its current state is more positive than what it used to be. More than three decades ago, the federal government stopped processing uranium at the Fernald site, and now it's a vast nature preserve. The journey from then to now involved lawsuits and new government regulations. The story is featured in this month's issue of Cincinnati Magazine. And joining Cincinnati Edition to discuss is the writer of that article, Jenny Wolfarth. She's a journalism professor also at the University of Cincinnati. Welcome, Jenny.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Good. If you'd like to join our conversation today, give us a call, 513-419-7100. You can also email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those into the show as well. So, Jenny, for those of us who may be unfamiliar or maybe those of us who have forgotten, where exactly is Fernald?
So Fernald is about 18 miles northwest of the city center of Cincinnati. It kind of straddles Crosby and Ross townships is where it's located.
So give us the history. How did this come to be?
So in 1951, the U.S. government used eminent domain to swipe up the property of about 11 private landowners, mostly farmers that were in that area, to build this facility. They had 30 days to get out. And then over the course of the next 40 years, uranium ore was initially transported to the site and processed in foundries here. And what happened there was they purified the uranium in what's called feed materials. And it was like the first step in the nuclear weapons process. So it created these fuel cores. They look like silver batons like you'd use in a track meet or something, except heavier and bigger. And those were what were put into nuclear reactors at the Hanford facility in the state of Washington. So this was the first step in it. That's what was created here for those 40 years when that plant was in operation here in Cincinnati.
And you got to go on a tour of this site, is how I read your article. And there were about 14 people or so that were part of this tour. What struck you about the site now?
So you're right. I did it was a Cincinnati Museum Center Heritage Tour that actually hooked me up with this originally that I found out about this. But what was cool, everything was cool about the tour. Like, I'm not a native Cincinnatian. I'm not from here originally. So I didn't have this whole backstory on what this place was. I was just like, oh, what a beautiful nature preserve this is. And then I'm like, you know, had heard a little bit about it. And when I went on this tour and, you know, in their amazing visitor center and went to the museum and learned all this stuff, I was like, this is a remarkable story here, which is why I pitched it to Cincinnati Magazine and they were game to go with that. And so to me, what was just remarkable is that this is something in our own backyard that people who were affected by it then, I'm sure, have deep, troubled memories of it, but a lot of us forget about it. So people might be finding this preserve just the natural way, like, hey, it's a cool place to go hiking or whatever. And others might still have a lot of fears about the place. So that's what really enticed me about doing this story.
Well, let's go back to 1951. You talked about how the federal government used eminent domain to acquire people's property, gave them about a month to get off of the site. You wrote in this piece for Cincinnati Magazine that when it opened, the Fernald site looked like it might be something from a pet food manufacturer with its red and white checkered water towers looking like the Purina logo. And you also note that for four decades, no one probed very deeply into what was going on there, even though it was processing uranium. So I'm curious, you're also a journalism professor. What was media coverage like at the beginning of this area's life as Fernald?
So there was a lot of coverage when the plant opened and about the eminent domain and about the impact it had on locals. But there was coverage sporadically throughout the years. I did a ton of research and looking into articles that have been written over the course of those years. But the bigger issue was that it was all kind of in the veil of secrecy. Like, people who worked at the plant didn't talk. They were, I think, instructed not to talk a lot about what happened at the plant or what their exact job was. And so there was a level of secrecy. And then people, like residents, like people I ended up talking with, like Lisa Crawford, who's key to the story, really just were living their lives across from what looked like an industrial plant. Literally, she lived across the street from it. And, you know, you're busy. You're taking your kid to school. You're paying your taxes. You're doing your job. And you don't necessarily pay a lot of attention to a big factory down the street or across the street. And so, yes, there was coverage, but it really wasn't. There weren't environmental regulations. There really wasn't a lot of fuss made about it until there needed to be a lot of fuss made about it.
Why so much secrecy?
I don't know. I think it was part of the identity of people who worked in this capacity for the Department of Energy, which was originally the U.S. Atomic Energy, but then, you know, became the Department of Energy. But the Cold War warrior idea that you were sort of, you know, you were holding the secrets of the government. I think there's a lot of mentality there that the folks who were working there thought this was their role, was to kind of be quiet. This is during the Cold War. There was so much secrecy about everything. I think people just kind of felt it was their duty to not really let out the government's secrets, is the impression I got from talking with former employees. I mean, even employees lots of employees I talked to, not all of them are quoted in the article, weren't sure exactly. They had a lot of fears about a lot of things. There were safety precautions and everything, but basically, I don't think there was a lot of making this very transparent and open.
What type of jobs were there? What types of opportunities did people have?
Well, I would guess it would be lots of forms of engineering.
So they were highly educated.
Chemical engineer. I mean, a lot of people had chemical engineering jobs. I'm trying to think of some of the job titles of some of the people that I interviewed. But there were also people who helped run a factory. So there were people who had what I would call more blue-collar jobs that didn't necessarily know everything that went in. They knew what safety precautions they had to take, what equipment they had to wear in different buildings. But it's a good question, because there were just normal jobs there.
Yeah, that's what I was curious about, was whether, you know, when a factory's opening in a rural place, you know, even though it can take some people's property, that people would be excited about the economic impact and the opportunities that locals would have for jobs. And I was curious whether that was something that happened here.
Absolutely. I mean, there were jobs because of that. And jobs are always valuable in rural communities or farming communities. And so there's probably lots of people who were grateful for the job opportunities, and then also felt proud to be working for the government. And, you know, it was just under secrecy, because it's like, hey, you're not supposed to tell the government secrets. We got this whole thing going with Russia. We got to kind of keep this on the down low or whatever. And that's what I think a lot of people felt their role was in working at the plant.
I'm wondering, considering the United States' relationship with Russia in that period, if that played a role in tempering people's negative reactions to what was happening in any way, if they felt a sense of patriotism or duty to the nation and saying, well, I got to let go of this property because it's important that the nation have this.
I think possibly. I mean, in terms of the folks who gave up the land, so I interviewed several people. I mean, a lot of them aren't around anymore. So yeah. I interviewed sons and daughters. For example, I interviewed Bill Nolman, who's family farm still sits on the right next to Fernald. They had, I'm trying to remember how much acreage they had, but the government took most of their acreage and they had a little bit left, and then they bought some nearby property. And he talks about what his father felt like at the time. And it was of course very disturbing to them to give up their family property, their acreage. But I do think you're right that sort of everybody felt like this is part of what we have to do to chip in. And I think that's how a lot of the employees felt. And perhaps people living near there felt that too. And it wasn't until everybody realized the implications, the environmental implications of what was being done there. And that was decades later, you know, that was four decades later. And then I think the story changed quite a bit.
Were the people who lost their property to the development of Fernald back in the early 50s, were they well compensated? Did they feel like they were being treated fairly?
They weren't. Initially, I don't think people would have felt that way, because some of them lost their livelihood. A lot of them moved. So I didn't really get into a lot of that in the story specifically, like how much each farmer was necessarily compensated. Later, after the civil lawsuit, I got into some more details about people and how they were. Those are the people that were affected by the environmental contamination after that.
You write in the article, this is a quote, "the ugly past of the site" is something that you reference at that point. What did you mean by that?
Well, this dark past that we're talking about, and that environmental contamination was going on there for these four decades, and chemicals, materials, water, it was seeping into the air, into the water, the groundwater. That's, you know, we're above the Great Miami Valley aquifer. The dark past is that bad stuff went down at Fernald, and for a long time. There weren't environmental protection regulations at that time. The EPA wasn't even started until 1970. And so the dark past to me is sort of what all happened and why it happened. And of course, it was during a time that was dark for everybody. I mean, there's this great part, part of the display in the museum that's at the visitor center, that is kind of replicates what it was like to do the air raids, the practice for the air raids in school. And, you know, it's like Tommy the Turtle or whatever. It's like, if this siren goes off, you put your heads on your desk. And I remember, my mom remembers this, you know, there are people who remember what it was like to be prepared for really awful things to happen during the Cold War. And many of us forget or didn't live through that. And of course, there's a lot of awful things that people are living through now in schools. But it harkens back to that time, which was really scary for people.
Was there any indication during that period that that particular area was possibly more prone to a threat?
That's a really good question. Like, do you mean if people were more afraid living?
Well, I suppose that if these, we know those drills were happening all over the place. People would get under their desk in case a nuclear bomb were coming. But was the security heightened in the area around Vernald because of what they were doing there?
I didn't get that sense. And I didn't get that sense from talking to the people around there, that everybody was sort of the same level of fearful about what was happening on a national level and trying to understand that. And I didn't get the sense that people thought they should be any more or less concerned just because there's a plant here located here in, you know, just north of Cincinnati.
And it turns out that really the concern didn't need to be about Russian bombs, but rather what was actually happening at the Vernald site.
Right.
So at what point did people start to realize after all these decades that something's amiss?
So really, the change really occurred around late 1984. There was a mass dust release. The plant was aging. And 300 pounds of enriched uranium oxide was expelled from this aging Vernald plant, and that got major coverage.
Tell us what that is.
I don't really know.
Okay.
It's like a
just
massive cloud of it's 300 pounds of stuff that I don't think you see in the air. I mean, it's literally it's like mini particles. I got a little bit into the science of this to understand like what we breathe in and the particles of air. You know, the story didn't really get into that degree of scientific depth, but it was expelled into the air, and then there was news coverage, and then people came knocking on the doors of local residents. Reporters were on it then, and they would say, for example, to Lisa Crawford, one of the main sources in the story, hey, what do you think about this big expel of gases? And again, you know, that's a working mom who is going back and forth to work and was like, I heard a little bit about it on the news or whatever. And then next thing you know, she's one of her well, her family well, she was directly across the street from the Vernald plant. And her well was one that was tested and had uranium. And that's what really got the advocacy started, the community rallied. And not everybody rallied the same. It was hard for folks like Lisa Crawford, who were kind of pounding on the door of the government and by then the EPA, and saying, hey, what's going on here? And what are the implications of this? I'm raising a 7-year-old son. And some people were receptive to that, and others really were not, because it was back to that whole idea of, look, we're this sense of patriotic duty, and you're kind of being a troublemaker. So there were some rough years there for folks like Lisa Crawford who stood up and said, we need to understand what's happening in our community and what's the impact this is going to have.
513-419-7100 is the number to call to join this conversation. We're going to talk more about that woman, Lisa Crawford, that you just referenced. She was quoted heavily in your article. And we'll have more on the history and the future of the Vernald site after this short break. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. It may be hard to believe that the same local site once used to process uranium is now a lush nature preserve. But the journey from Cold War relic to Field of Green was an arduous one, fraught with lawsuits and new regulations from the government. Let's continue now with Ginny Wolfarth. She's a journalism professor at the University of Cincinnati and a freelance journalist who has a new story about Vernald in the June issue of Cincinnati Magazine. 513-419-7100 is the number to call to join our conversation today. Let's go to the phone lines now. Frank is on the line. Hi, Frank.
Hello.
What's your question or comment, Frank?
I owned a moving company back in the late 80s and early 90s. And I was a minority mover, and they sent me some information about relocating the building materials at the Vernald plant. And then we had to view the plant, went out there and take a tour. And when we went out there, they gave us badges. And my badge went to, I guess they considered it an unsafe level. And then when we left after the tour, they wouldn't answer any of my phone calls. Nobody would contact me anymore. I wrote them several letters, and I never heard from them again.
Well, what kind of badge are you talking about? Is it just some ID badge, or was there something that meant to measure?
These were badges that were meant to measure, I guess, radiation levels. From my understanding.
Is your suspicion then that you didn't get a call back because of what you witnessed?
Yes, that was my suspicion. I really have no facts about it, but I thought it was strange because I went through a lot of expense and trouble to offer the bid to relocate the building materials because, they was completely disassembling the plant altogether. And I had a moving company, and there were several moving companies involved.
Before I let you go, Frank, because we are short on time, I just want to ask, what type of materials did you anticipate you would have been moving off of the site? Just like the office stuff?
No. This was torn down materials.
Okay.
Like wood, metal, disassembled.
Just construction debris.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
Things like that.
Frank, that's a very interesting story. We appreciate you calling. Thanks a lot. 513-419-7100 is the number to call if you'd like to join. Burke is on the line. Hi, Burke. What's your question or comment?
Well, I was going to make a comment that my father was the medical director for the atomic energy plant over in Pikestone, Ohio, which was a sister plant of Fernald. And this was in the late 50s, and it was back to your discussion about how did people feel back then, and we just lived normal everyday lives, and my father worked out there. He hardly ever talked about it. It was just like going to work at some other kind of industrial plant. And however, he was not allowed to talk about what went on out there, and as far as I know, all the people that worked at the plant, they had to get security clearance before they could be hired to work there.
Wow, that's a great story for sharing, Burke. Really illuminates what we're talking about. Thanks so much for the call. 513-419-7100 is the number. Next on the line is Chris. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you doing?
We're doing well. What's your question or comment?
Well, my comment again was about the secrecy at the plant. I worked there for a couple years. Matter of fact, I left right at the time the dust exposure happened. But even in the 80s, when you're going into the plant, they had signs up that were very similar to loose lips and ships. And they had those signs changed usually once a month. And I imagine in the 50s, they were even more pointed because in the 50s, you got to remember that plant originally was a Department of Defense plant. So we had 12-foot fences with razor wire on the top. They were double fences. So, it was considered an extremely secret operation.
Chris, that's nice of you to call and share that perspective, and very interesting to help us illuminate what we're talking about here. 513-419-7100 is the number. The phone lines are starting to ring. We're going to have some more callers coming up. But before we went to break, Jenny, and just to remind everyone, I'm talking to Jenny Wolfarth. She's got an article in Cincinnati Magazine currently about the Fernald site. We were talking about Lisa Crawford and her husband, Ken, who lived nearby there. They were told in 1985 that theirs was one of three backyards near Fernald to be contaminated with uranium. So this isn't like we have a monthly gardening show where people call and are like, oh, I've got a mole problem in my backyard. Can you imagine being told that you've got uranium contamination? I want to read a piece from your article, this piece of your writing. Quote, I was just this nice, quiet housewife who minded her own business and went to work every day and raised her family and did what she was supposed to do until they turned me into a wild person, Lisa Crawford said in a recorded 1999 interview. That's because she got active. So what happened next after she was informed about her backyard?
Man, Lisa Crawford, she raised Holy Hell is what happened next. And she got other people to help her raise Holy Hell. They attended community meetings. She reached out when they weren't getting the answers that they felt they needed from the government representatives that were there at the plant. You know, she reached out to local media. She had John Glenn in her living room multiple times. You know, she really, really raised a ruckus. And it wasn't just her. She's so humble. She's so kind. She's just like she describes herself. She is as ordinary as you and me and your mom. And she really did feel that she had to take action. And she wasn't a person who was destined for grassroots advocacy. She was a working mom. And but her son could have been affected by this. They had a 7-year-old son that when they found the uranium in their, it was their well in their backyard. They were renting that property from the Nolmans, the farmer I talked about earlier. So it took her and a lot of other people and community advocacy. I mean, what is remarkable to me about the story of Fernald is that it did end up being a good story in the end, or at least a story of recovery or restoration in the end. Because, man, there are many, many, many sites like this around the country, and there are not these kinds of happy endings at those other stories. And Lisa would be the first to testify to that, that she is now friends with all these people, that the people who did work at Fernald have tried to reach out and help other people at other sites. And we're very lucky that we've had this level of restoration and conclusion here, because that's not the same at other sites.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Up next is Sherry. Hi, Sherry. What's your question or comment?
Well, my comment is my father was a local 44 iron worker, and I just recall when he would come home from different jobs, us kids would help him pull his coveralls off. But when he came home from Fernald, my mom would insist us kids not get near him. She'd help him pull his coveralls off, and she'd take them right to the laundry. And it obviously gave us some concern. And all these years later, he's had an awful lot of – he's gone now, too. So his mom. Mom passed from cancer. But there were a lot of iron workers that worked with him at Fernald that did die from cancer also. And obviously, there's questions there. I don't think there'll be any, you know, answers, I mean, if the families didn't pursue it at the time. But it sure makes you wonder.
Sherry, thanks so much for sharing that story. We appreciate it very much. Let's go now to Don. Don is on the line. Hi, Don. What's your question or comment?
Hey, yeah, I grew up in the area as part of the lawsuit and all that stuff. I also worked there during the cleanup. And for all the bandits happened there in the past, these people down there now, I was there yesterday when doing a nature thing. I was there with my granddaughter. My 10-year-old granddaughter and my wife yesterday. We go down there all the time and enjoy the place. Now, DOE's made up for it. For all the bad that's happened in the past, it's turned it around, and they're making up for it now. It's a great place. Very well managed.
Thanks.
That's all I have.
Thanks for the call, Don. We appreciate it very much. Next in line is Doug. Hi, Doug. What's your question or comment?
So I was a former employee at the site, largely involved with the cleanup, and I just wanted to make one job. Time that cleanup occurred, it probably really was one of the more state-of-the-art environmental remediation efforts in the world. And a lot of good people put a lot of time, a lot of effort into it. And I certainly recognize some of the secrecy involved with the plant early on and just some of the issues around the general contamination of the area. But I did want to highlight the fact that, from my perspective at least, the cleanup was above board and involved a lot of good people, which I think if you go to the site today, previous commenters had talked about the nature preserve, you can witness that firsthand. So that's all I really had.
Thanks so much for the call, Doug. We appreciate it. Donna, you are up next. Hi, Donna. What's your question or comment?
I have a comment. My mother, who's long gone, worked nearby at the Procter & Gamble, Miami Valley Laboratories, for about 20 years, and she retired in 88. Because she was a health nut, she would go out every day on her lunch hour and walk a whole hour in those, you know, rural areas, and breathing in we don't know what from the Fernald plant. And after, I guess, the plant closed down, the Fernald, they gave, I don't know if it was yearly health exams to their employees, or maybe it was just people like my mother who were outdoors a lot, rain or shine, 365 a year. And luckily, nothing ever showed up on her health exams. And I don't know if the exams were from Fernald, the government, or who. But she did not die of anything from there. So I just thought there might be other people from P&G that are aware of this situation that were involved, you know, back in that time frame.
Donna, we appreciate you sharing your story very much. Thanks so much for the call. Did you heard anything about that, Jenny?
Yeah. So there was a lot of lawsuits that came out of this, and there were lawsuits that were from workers who got a monitoring program. So to answer that last kind of speak to that last caller's point. There was a Fernald medical monitoring program, which was for citizens of the area. That came out of the class action lawsuit, the lawsuit that the Crawfords filed. That was a $3 million lawsuit that was filed in 1985. It was settled 4 years later for $78 million. And part of that was for this Fernald medical monitoring program. And that is a remarkable thing in its own right. But it continues to track a cohort of 9,782 people who lived within a five-mile radius of the Fernald plant. Now, this is separate from there was an employee. If you were an employee of the plant, there was a separate lawsuit and settlement that would provide, as she was talking about, regular medical monitoring for these folks. But that there was one for employees, there was one for citizens. So what has been found, and this information was from Dr. Susan Penny. She's with UC College of Medicine's Department of Environmental Health. And they have found evidence of uranium exposure that is linked to cases of lupus, renal disease, kidney, and urinary cancers. And now they're looking at the transgenerational effects, which means they're interviewing sons and daughters of citizens, people who live within that five-mile radius. What's remarkable about the data that they found is actually a surprisingly positive benefit, which is all these 9,780 people who were getting this regular monitoring. These are just the citizens, not the employees, because there's a whole bunch more that were employees. The fact that they were getting regular medical monitoring that the rest of us don't necessarily are that good about all the time, there was early detection of some cancers that helped them have a better survival rate. So cancers like breast cancer, where early detection is really critical, it allowed people who may not have ever known that they had cancers inside of them be a part of this very intense medical monitoring, and therefore that might have prolonged their life. So it's just one of those things that a bad situation ended up requiring this medical monitoring or people participating in this, which might have ended up saving their lives. Of course, if they hadn't had the exposure in the first part, they might not have had these cancers, these diseases. But it was really fascinating to listen to Dr. Penny talk about the data from that. And that's ongoing research, even though the original funding for that it was gone a long time ago, but they've got done other funding. They've done it for on a volunteer basis since then, this team of researchers. So, and I'm also really so touched by what people were saying, that they people who were worked at the plant and who acknowledged that there really were a lot of good people who tried to make this right. And that includes the government, and that includes the people that are at the preserve today, and these citizens and local researchers and UC professors and all these people, EPA officials, that tried to fix something that was broken. And I agree with the assessment that it's a pretty good outcome for something that could have had a much, much less happy ending.
$4.4 billion spent, a big lawsuit that followed. You can read all about that in the June issue of Cincinnati Magazine. It is on newsstands and online now. Our thanks to Jenny Wolfarth for joining us. Thanks so much, Jenny.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. I'm Michael Monks. Subscribe to our podcast at wvxu.org.